Welcome, everyone. I am Bob Wurzelbacher, the director of the Respect Life Office for the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, and this is our video podcast series that we call Being Pro-Life. Each month, we discuss a different topic in the Respect Life arena. We'll hear a personal story from someone deeply affected by that issue, and finally, we'll share ways that you can get involved. This month's topic is capital punishment, and as always, we have a special guest. Will you please introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Kwame Kumau Ajamu, Chairman, Witness to Innocence, and a survivor of death row. I served 28 years for a crime I did not commit.
All right. So Kwame, there's a book about you and the story of the others that were convicted of the same crime who were all innocent. And that book is called Good Kids, Bad City. So I read that book. I know a little bit about your story. Why don't we start by telling the listeners back to the beginning? What was the crime, right, that you were accused of? What were you actually doing that day? And at what point did the police come knocking on your door?
The crime was aggravated murder, attempted aggravated murder. It happened on May 19th, 1975. My friend, Ricky Jackson, who was like 6 months older than me, something like that. At the time, I was 18. I was 17 years old. We were locals that were hombres, too. And what I mean by that is sometimes I may spend the night over his house, and sometimes he may spend the night over my house. So at this particular day, he had stayed over my house. So we got up early, went out, and we went up to the basketball court, which was approximately maybe a mile's walk at a school in the plateau. And we played ball for a while, shot around, come back into the late afternoon, not something after three, maybe. Unbeknownst to us that this crime had taken place in the neighborhood, wherein a United States money order salesman, white man, 69 years old, by the name of Harold J. Franks, came into our neighborhood, this little store. It was, I would say, perfect for a robbery because you could hit it and right to the highway and gone, right? This is where Mr. Franks lost both his liberty and his life. The proprietor's wife, Mrs. Anna Robinson, was also struck by gunfire in the neck as she looked out of the windows to observe what had gone on. 5 days later, Cleveland police would raid my mother's home at something like 5:36 in the morning. I would understand and find out later that they had an arrest warrant for both Ricky Jackson and Wiley Bridgman, which is my older brother, by 3 years. When the police raided my house, they had guns blazing. I was asleep. They woke me up at gunpoint. I looked and I noticed that, man, it had to be 8-9 cops in there with guns. I'm just 17 years old. The first thing I thought was my mom. I bolted past the cops, which they let me do, and they chased me into her room. And when I got into her room and saw that there were cops in there like they were in mine, I lost it. I began to get irate. I cursed them out. And at that point, was a white shirt there, maybe a sergeant or something. Ordered one of the regular cops to detain me. So he said, well, what do you want me to do with him? He said, well, take him down. We'll sort it out later.
So they had a warrant for your brother and your friend, Ricky, and yeah, they just took you with them because you were there.
This is the incident that got me into this everything, right?
Right.
They couldn't take me down because I was just 17, and they went to the juvenile detention home. I learned that I was there for simple obstruction of police business. After 2 weeks, I learned that I was written into this murder. After 2 weeks, I became the boy that was standing outside of Mrs. Robinson's store drinking a pop or some kind of beverage when the white man went in the store. And then the same beverage I threw in his face, and somewhere had a club and I hit him with a club and none of that worked. And so that's when Ricky, the other boy, shot him, right? So I became this guy. It just wrote me right in the story. And so it took 39 years of my life to erase that.
I've read a number of stories now myself. Maybe a lot of listeners out there, they still have a whole lot of faith, right, in the justice system. They imagine if someone is wrongfully convicted, it's probably a pretty rare situation. What happened? How did this happen? What got you convicted if you and your friends and your brother didn't commit this crime?
There are so many working parts into wrongful incarceration. It's mind-boggling. When this particular thing happened in 1975 to Mr. Franks, I learned that there were also six other individuals who had been in the county jail who was also being looked at for this particular matter. However, on the day that this happened and in our particular situation, and we walked up to see because we were there in the neighborhood, there was a child there, 12 years old at the time, by the name of Edward Vernon, a little skinny boy with a pop bottle, glasses, and a big head, and guys thumped him on his head, and you know, that guy. And so he knew everybody because he was a paper boy. When the cops asked, who did it? Edward raised his hand and they swooped him up and they took him in. But what happened was once he got there, they learned that Edward was an habitual liar, one who fantasized and made up a lot of stories all the time just to be famous. The reason why Edward continued to say we did it, and they used it, his testimony in four court appearances. His mother was dying of ovarian cancer, and Edward never had adult custody of his family with him at no time because his mother was dying of ovarian cancer. Edward would testify in 2014 in Ricky's trial of the exoneration that those cops slammed books, kicked doors and chairs and called him all kind of names and liars and told that 12-year-old boy that if he didn't come out of there and say what he told them he saw, they would go and arrest his mother who was dying in the hospital and put her in jail in this place. And I realized Edward was more of a victim than even the three of us.
So your conviction was based upon the eyewitness testimony of a 12-year-old child. So why do you think the police wanted to convict the three of you in particular? Why did they want to convince this 12-year-old boy to eye you?
Edward initiated it by saying that he saw us, which clamped the let's clear up the books. They already had men in county jail that they could have cleared the books up, but they didn't have a witness. Here come three that had a witness. And it was just that simple.
They thought it was their best case. They didn't have any physical evidence on anybody, I guess.
On anybody. And to this day, they still don't.
It still seems unusual to me that three people would be sent to the death penalty only on one 12-year-old boy's eyewitness statement. That seems unusual, but that's what happened. And how would that happen?
So one in three people who are tried and convicted of capital murder, depending on demographics, finances, and of course, the color of their skin, will get the death penalty. There are six counties only of the 88 in the state of Ohio that dare to have capital punishment as the ultimate sentence. The very first reason is the fact that it costs oodles and oodles and oodles of money to just put on a capital murder case. Everybody that is called up to witness has to be expert, has to be paid. The money spent in that trial can send a person to jail for murder for 20 years. And then you go down the line with maybe you got this prosecutor. You do it this way and that's the way it is. Or the overzealous cops that we had in our case. And then ultimately is the fact that it was just three little black boys when nobody gonna mess.
So when you're going through this, you're at this trial, you know you're innocent, you know your brother's innocent, you know your friend Ricky's innocent. Were you thinking at this time, okay, they're going to figure this out, the jury's not going to convict me? Or were you really worried? Were you confident the system would know you were innocent? Where were you at that time and how surprised were you when you were convicted?
I got on the fence about halfway through the trial because of the legal representation that I had. So I found out that you needed money in order to be properly represented by a lawyer. At various points in the trial, I just knew the man was a pathetic drunk and he was asleep half the time during the trial. I'm expecting this guy to stand up, man, and do the rub your tie thing that Perry Mason would do and without saying I object, but everybody got it. You know, he never did that stuff, you know. He never, ever once did that. I think it's two objections in my entire trial. And one of them came from me. That made me actually became an activist because it was then, it was that time, it was when I realized that it was either me or the grave.
So you realized halfway through the trial that this was not going your way. So then you get the guilty verdict and then it was of death. Was there anything going on in that said, okay, where they said, plead guilty, we'll give you life, but if you plead innocent.
In between the two events of which you spoke was the judge himself ushered me back into his chambers and offered me 10 flat years. Hey, man, before we get to this, there's a deal on the table for you to take 10 years. This is his words. You're 17. You'll be out when you're 27. You can go on with your life. You can do everything you want. And I looked at him and I said, but what if I didn't do the crime, judge? He said, then, son, I'm going to have to sentence you to the full extent of the law should you be found guilty. And we went back to court, and I'd be damned if that wasn't what he did.
Wow. So tell us, so what happened? Why did you get off of death row?
So in August of 1978, a woman by the name of Sandra Lockett, who herself was on death row, she filed against the constitutionalities of capital punishment here in the state of Ohio at that particular time. And the ruling came back in our favor that all the judges seemingly were doing the same thing, ruling actually in premeditation when there was none, and thus giving you the higher sentence, which of course was death. In August of 1978, we would be, I like to use the word exonerated now, from death row, but only to go into a life sentence in the general population.
So you get to the general population, and then you're still, I guess, working on an appeals process, right? You're still trying to get your conviction overturned, I imagine, right? How did that happen? How long were you working on it this whole time? And at what point did you get a break?
So what happened was once we got off of death row, I got into education. I got transferred down from Lucasville to Lima. And this was in 84. We were able to get education. And I would become the educational administration clerk. And from 1984 until 2003, when I was released from prison, that is the position that I held.
So having that education, is that part of what gave you the information you needed to figure out how to start working your case again?
Yes and no. Ricky and I and my brother, we had actually started trying to reach out because we'd heard that these guys in New Jersey and upper state New York was trying to put something together for innocence, you know, to help people with innocence. But it just couldn't jive for us because they were in Jersey and it was no intermediates, you know. But it would take years after that. And so by that time, I had went through the system and made a parole. And, you know, and just it just seemed like to me that the administration was saying, you know, this guy here, let's just see what he do in the world. Let's let him go. And after a 10-year continuance, I went to the board in 2002 in October, and it gave me a parole. I was overjoyed. And so in January 27 of 2003, I stepped out of prison a free man. Not exonerated, but just free on parole.
I'm sorry, I have to back up just a little bit. So you were not sent to death row for actual murder, right? You weren't the trigger man. I think there are a lot of people that already would be surprised. Even if you had done that, why would you be put on death row for that? That's a question even right there. But anyway, so you were, but is the fact that you were not considered the killer, is that part of the reason why maybe they offered parole?
No. To enter the prison, you can have a band of Indians. But once they get in the prison, they become singles. Each case now is dealt with how you live in prison. And I was one of those guys that I didn't get into things outside of the realm of that school and the boxing ring. That's all I did. I didn't get what they call the tickets, the write-ups and this and that. So actually, when I went to the parole board, I had been ticket-free or incident-free with something like 14 years. And it was something about my shoes. You only allowed so much. I think I had too many shoes. They wrote me up for it and I had to send some out.
So your worst crime in jail was having too many shoes. So good behavior was a big part of your parole, I guess.
That was like 14 years before going to, you know, because, you know, hey, man, I was looking at when I first went to the parole board, it was 1990, 15 years in. And they gave me a 5-year continuance. And I said, oh, man, it was on a Friday. I said, man, I ain't going to call my mom. I'll wait, the weekend because I just don't make the old lady sad, you know. Didn't get a chance. She died.
Wow. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
I know. But I tell you, out of that came, well, who are you talking to? Kwame. Right. Kwame means what?
You have to tell me.
Born on Saturday. She passed away on Friday. So after I did all the soul searching and all that, and born on Saturday. So when I changed my name to Kwame, it meant that everything behind me was just that.
Right.
Ajamu means he fights for what he wants.
That's incredible. It's a very purposeful name change because your name was Ronnie Bridgman?
Ronnie Bridgman.
Is that right?
That's right.
So you get out on parole. So real quick on this one, you've got a heavy conviction on your record. What are you able to do as a so-called free man? What kind of opportunity do you have to get a job with your record?
Oh, man, that's a great. That was really great. I love you for that question. So let me say two things. Luckily, the state of Ohio, I could vote, right? So that wasn't the problem. Some states, you know, ex-cons can't vote. But the state of Ohio, I could vote. But the other thing was the fingerprint. You can't have a dirty fingerprint up in here in Ohio. And I had murder and capital murder on this fingerprint, right? So the very first job I got was for $5 an hour, $6 an hour, working at World Resource, and it was a recycling bin up St. Clair. And man, I used to have filth up to top of my chest, shirt pockets, right, every day. But I did that job. I got good at it. I got me a telephone, little cell phone I'd never had before, you know. Yeah. $6 an hour. But then I got lucky and I got a temporary job at the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections, which I would stay there for 9.5 years, right? That job got a little bit more money because it was $10 an hour as a temporary worker. You know, you only come like during the elections because I couldn't. I was really good, though. They made me a boss. They made me actually a zone captain, man. I was in charge of the entire city of Euclid, Ohio. Whatever election happened between 2004, I kid you not, to 2012, Kwame Ajamu was the one that ran those elections. It was my crew that did it, right? But I still got $10 an hour. That job paid like $62,000 a year. But I had murder on that finger, so I couldn't even tell them people about that. I just sat quiet and took them $10 an hour and did that job. What I mean by that finger, fellas, is that you have to get fingerprinted to get a good job, especially a county job. Right. So if I had to put my finger in the ink and they ran it through what they call CODIS or whatever it is, it would have came back with probably 3 red lines saying, right, murderer, 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 right, you know.
You wouldn't have been able to get that job.
I wouldn't have been able. Even the job that I had, I would have had to leave that too, because they'd been like, oh my God, you know, because they didn't know. They didn't know. And so that's the fear. I did everything that I ran pre-release for like 2 years before getting out. So I was sending guys home with resumes. I knew how to make the big resumes. So I said, you know what, I'm going to try. Now, this was before I got the job at the recycling bin. I said, I'm going to try it myself, what I've been teaching these guys that I've been sending out. I'm going to go to a temp agency. Yeah, I've been to prison and this and that, you know. So I'm sitting there. So finally the guy said, well, you've been in prison? I said, sure I have, you know. So it's sometimes, you know, it works for the best. You know, we got some companies that hire, you know, ex-cons. He said, so what you do? I said, murder. He got real quiet, you know.
Yeah.
And so he said, murder. So his pen is tapping now on the table, you know. So he said, what was it, manslaughter? I said, no, I was sentenced to die. I was on death row. I got to go talk to my manager. Dude, he probably ain't came back yet, you know. I sit there about 20 minutes. He didn't come back. I said, yeah, I just got up and left, you know.
You didn't? Did you bother saying I was innocent?
Or no, it, I didn't.
Don't even laugh. Bother. For what it's worth, I was innocent. You decided that doesn't work, and you just had to keep quiet.
Had to keep quiet.
Wow. Okay, so you did this job not letting anybody know what your record was. So this is how you're living for a while. And but at this time, your brother's still in prison, right? Your friend Ricky's still in prison.
So I hold it now. So this is where everything changes, and it starts to get better. Because I meet the greatest person in the world, and I married her. Well, should I say, she liked me enough to marry me. And my wife has been my A1 since day one. She's an avenger. She's also on the board of murder victims, family members. She's great, you know. But we met, we fell in love, we got married. She caressed me and she embraced my story and my innocence and helped me. And I went and found a lawyer by the name of Terry Gilbert. And the reason why I found Terry Gilbert was because of a man by the name of Sam Shepard and his son, Sam Ree Shepard, who went and got Terry Gilbert to try to clear his father's name. And I said, oh, wow, Terry Gilbert knows about old murder, because Sam Shepard's case was in 1954.
Come on.
And so Terry Gilbert knows about old murder. So this is the guy that I need to talk to. And so I find Terry Gillett's number and I call him, and he was so intrigued. He was with this old case. And I go in and I see him and we talk, man, for about an hour. And he said, what you need is a highlight. He said, I'm going to give you that. And it came in the name of a young kid, 24 years old at that time, by the name of Kyle Swenson, who was a writer for the Cleveland Scene magazine. We met downtown at Starbucks, and he had a little dictaphone, and he had a pen, just like a real gumshoe, right? He's a kid, man. I'm looking at him. I said, man, you know, I was in prison longer than you've been alive, dude.
Right, exactly.
But I didn't say it to him. I'm thinking this, right? But at the time, I said, okay, what the heck? I mean, Terry Gilbert sent me to this guy, right?
Right.
Little did I know we would make history. So we go to talk. And he's writing him. And so then he stopped. He said, let me ask you something. He said, do you have any paperwork? I would find out that it's the one thing that reporters really love, right? I said, man, I got boxes in the car. He said, oh, my God. He went and got it. 3 days later, he called me. And his first words was, he said, Kwame, he said, I want to say, man, on the behalf of all humanity and that justice, I'm so sorry for the way they treated you and your brothers. And he got behind my case because in that was the three transcripts. Well, the four, the three originals and the one for the last trial. And in each case, the only witness that they had, that 12-year-old kid, told four different stories. And he was wondering, why come did nobody else see this? And that was the start of my exoneration.
Wow. So make this long story short, I guess, so that the lawyers are telling him to tell the story in the way that's going to best convict the person on trial at that moment.
Exactly.
I suppose that's the story, right? So he finds that out. He writes his article. So the world's finding out a little bit about your story, but then it all hinges on Ed Vernon, that 12-year-old boy's story. So now you're trying to get a hold of Ed in order to see if he might recant his story or perhaps exactly. Find out why it is that he told the story as he did in the first place. So then who and how did somebody get a hold of Ed, and how did he come into the process of getting these retrials?
As it turned out, my wife worked with a lady that was at a church that just happened to be the same church that Ed was in. And she mentioned that to my wife, because before the book was two articles that Kyle wrote. What the boy saw was the very first one. And so now folks knew about the case, but it fizzled. It wasn't nothing. So she said, well, that guy, he goes to church with me. And so I tried to call him, and that didn't work. I talked with Pastor Singleton. But then Ed had a nervous breakdown, and they went into the hospital. And the reason why he had the nervous breakdown was because so much pressure was on him.
Decades of knowing he put three innocent men on death row. So he wasn't answering phone calls at first, but when he ended up in the hospital.
Yes, reality was catching up with him, and he was running because he was getting ready to get some kind of commission in the church right when I started calling. And he ran away from that ceremony, you know, and then I called again, and the pastor like, well, what's going on, you know? And the pastor and I talked a lot, and he hung up, and he went, and you know, it just broke him down, you know? Yeah.
So then after that episode, his pastor convinced him that he needed to go set things straight?
Right. He would say that over the course of the years, I think up until he was like 25 or so, he was 12 when it started, he was going back to the same cops that cohorted him in the first place.
Right.
And he'd say they pat him on his back and, you know, set him on his way.
Yeah. Right. Because they obviously don't want the story to come out. Well, he finally agrees to do this. What happens then?
Yeah. And so on November the 20th, when he's sitting in that trial and they tried to badger him and berate him. And, you know, he just kept saying, I'm a grown man now. You know, I'm not a child anymore. And said, I'm not afraid of you. And that's not what happened, you know. And he told his side of the story and he wouldn't back up, you know. The evidence was overwhelming in the courtroom. And Mr. Gentry, the prosecutor, he threw up both his hands, man. During the course of the court, he left out. And then he came back with all his people. And he said, you ain't no sense in doing this here. It's obvious that this man is innocent. And that was a great day for justice.
Right. Now, is there any recourse of prosecutorial incompetence or even criminal behavior on the part of the prosecution back in 1975? Anything like that? They're kind of beyond that kind of a accusation.
They are. And one of the great things that we in this movement, witnessing in my organization as well, are striving to do is change just that, because they have immunity, absolute immunity. And it's just a sad day when we can have a bureaucracy run with, well, they can either be bought, they can be traded, or they can use their own self-indulgence and commit these crimes against other humanity. That's something that I think we need to, as a people, stop letting happen, is public officials have absolute immunity.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about Witness to Innocence then now, and how can regular listeners get involved in trying to abolish the death penalty here in Ohio?
So Witness to Innocence is the absolute great organization that I just happen to be blessed with being the chairman of. It is an organization by, of, and for its own people. Everyone in the organization is a death row, a survivor like myself. The director, Kurt Bloodsworth, myself, the chairman, Kwame Ajamu, all of our board of directors are either members of this organization or family members of this organization. We have 1, 2, 3 lawyers on board as facilitators as well. WitnessToInnocent.org. You can go up there and enclose this. Every denomination of how Witness to Innocence is active and proactive in this fight against capital punishment. There are measures on here for donations. There are actions to be taken in every case. Most importantly, Witness to Innocence is the one and only organization that represents the ending of capital punishment from a physical prospect, and that being all of its members are former death row survivors.
Now, there's a movement right now because there's a bill heading on through, as you know, right through the Senate here in Ohio and through the House in Ohio, two separate bills all about abolishing the death penalty. How can people get involved?
This is a great bipartisan partaking here in Ohio, probably the biggest bipartisan get together I've seen for capital punishment. And I would say to all Ohioans to write and contact those in the General Assembly, starting with the two senators I mentioned, Nikki Antonio and Senator Steve Hoffman, who's pushing the bill. And let's support these people as much as we can, as best we can.
Okay. So if you go to nodeathpenaltyoh.com, nodeathpenaltyoh.com, you can click on toolkit and you get some talking points, things you can put on social media. So you even get what to say to your senator to help them support the bill, letter writing tool, all kinds of things. If you want to know information about it, maybe you're not convinced yet that the death penalty should be repealed. Perhaps that's where you're sitting. Perhaps reading some of these links over here on these fact sheets might help change your mind as well. What is this lobby day that's happening in Ohio?
So the 19th of October is the big lobby day that, and I'm hoping that it goes down, actually, you know, because of the COVID situation, we don't know.
At the time of recording here in August of 2021, it's planned on October 19th, 2021. They're working on a possible virtual version, but certainly go to nodeathpenaltyoh.com, click on lobby day, and we'll find out, you know, whether it's virtual or in person. But either way, you can certainly get involved in that event. So great. Anything else would you suggest that people do?
If you don't know as much about capital punishment and especially death penalty and how it happens to individuals, I strongly suggest you go to witnesstoinnocence.org. We can tell you about at least 185 surviving cases. And there you should have enough to make you realize that this is more than just, you know, black and white.
Right. And when you read these stories of these people that were wrongly convicted and are finally released, and how difficult for it was for them to be exonerated, you have to presume there have to be a whole lot more people that aren't exonerated. It's not like everybody that's innocent has been exonerated. All right. Well, Kwame, thank you so much for spending time with us today, for sharing your story, for helping educate us on why it is that we should be trying to overturn the death penalty here in Ohio and here in the United States and how to get involved. So thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to thank all of our viewers and listeners for tuning in on this episode of our Being Pro-Life series. Head to the website to view the links talked about in this episode at www.catholicaoc.org/beingpro-life. Thank you again for joining us today. I look forward to being with you next time.